You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
What does it mean to live in a wounded world? What does it mean to live in a world that is scarred, that is wounded by war, by violence, by racism and white supremacy, by empire and colonialism? Those were the pressing questions that Du Bois was wrestling with during his lifetime. And those are still questions that we're wrestling with today.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile. And the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I was born by a golden river and in the shadow of two great hills, 5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. The house was quaint, with clapboards running up and down, neatly trimmed, and there were five rooms, a tiny porch, a rosy front yard, and unbelievably delicious strawberries in the rear. A South Carolinian, lately come to the Berkshire Hills, owned all of this. We were his transient tenants for a time. My own people were part of a great clan. Fully 200 years before, Tom Burghardt had come through the Western Pass from the Hudson with his Dutch captor, sullen in his slavery, and achieving his freedom by volunteering for the revolution at a time of sudden alarm. Tom died about 1787, but of him came many sons, and one, Jack, helped in the War of 1812. W.E.B. Du Bois was one of the best writers of his times who could explain the experience of being a person of color at the time of the new 20th century better than anyone.
Du Bois is truly a singular figure in American history. He lived a remarkable life. He was born in 1868 during the presidency of Andrew Johnson during Reconstruction. He died in 1963 in Accra, Ghana, literally the day before the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, 95 years.
That's Chad Williams. Chad Williams is the Samuel J. and Augusta Spector Professor of History and African and African American Studies at Brandeis University. He's also the author of The Wounded World, W.E.B. Du Bois and the First World War.
He authored an incredible 22 single-authored books in history, sociology, literature, you name it. There's really no other individual like him in American history.
Lions have no historians, and therefore, lion hunts are thrilling and satisfactory human reading. We have had no bards, and therefore it has been widely told how American philanthropy freed the slaves. In truth, we revolted by armed rebellion, sullen refusal to work, running away to the North and Canada, and by furnishing 200,000 soldiers and many times as many civilian helpers in the Civil War. You see in his writing the importance of service in the military and the connection between service in the military and citizenship.
As a historian, as someone who was born just a few years after the Civil War, I mean, he had a deep appreciation for and even reverence for the Black military tradition. Going back to the American Revolution, his great-great-grandfather was very proud of him serving in the American Revolution. His father briefly served in the Civil War. So he definitely linked war and Black military service in particular with the acquisition of citizenship rights and the broader acquisition of freedom.
We're going to talk to Chad Williams about that and about a decision that W.E.B. Du Bois made that was very controversial and one that he would deal with for the rest of his life. So we're talking to Chad Williams, the author of The Wounded World, W.E.B. Du Bois and the First World War. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for inviting me.
Seems like a larger-than-life figure.
He was at the forefront of nearly every major issue facing African Americans in the 20th century. He was founder of what we consider today the modern civil rights movement. He was one of the forerunners of Pan-Africanism and struggles for African independence. And he was just an incredible scholar, really the quintessential scholar activist in African-American history. Now, he was one of the co-founders of the NAACP, the only African-American recognized as one of the founders, even though there were others involved in some of the initial discussions to create the NAACP. He also took control of its news magazine.
When we look back now and the image of Woodrow Wilson today, I mean, they're removing his name off Princeton in various places. And now there's much more awareness of Woodrow Wilson's racial views. But W.E.B. Du Bois supports him. That was kind of an oddball thing, right? In politics at that time, an African-American, first of all, to be a Democrat or to be supporting a Democratic candidate.
Yeah. Du Bois really made a leap of faith in supporting Wilson. In 1912, Du Bois was briefly a member of the Socialist Party. He set aside his membership, the Socialist Party, and really reasoned that because Woodrow Wilson was educated, more erudite, even though he was from the South, he was not a rabid white supremacist like many other politicians, Southern politicians were at the time. He felt that he would be fair when it came to African Americans, even likening him to potentially the next Abraham Lincoln. So he, unlike the majority of African Americans at the time, voted for the Democratic candidate. Most African Americans were staunch Republicans. And he was gravely mistaken by his support for Woodrow Wilson. Folly of supporting Wilson and his administration became clear to Du Bois very quickly.
Really quickly, like 1913, it seems like they're just, first of all, I'm not sure if Wilson really did much to say thank you or anything like that. Maybe Tumulty. He seemed to send Tumulty out for all the interactions with the African-American.
And Du Bois corresponded directly with Tumulty.
Yeah, it very quickly get disappointment on appointments to the civil service. And there is a tension there. How much of it is Wilson, right? And how much of it is he's forced? Because Wilson, of course, gets elected with the South, which is at this point the Redeemer governments. And he needs congressional support from Texas. And how much is neglect and how much is what Wilson wanted to do, you know, is always a, I don't even know if it's an answerable question there.
Yeah, well, I think it is. I mean, you know, politics is politics. And Wilson was a very shrewd politician, maybe not shrewd enough, especially when it came to the League of Nations and that debacle. But Wilson was also a white supremacist, without question. He was a more sophisticated white supremacist, but one nevertheless. He believed that segregation was in the best interests of both white people and black people. In this way, he was very reflective of kind of the Southern strain of progressivism, which saw Jim Crow as the best way to solve what was characterized as the race problem. So his segregation of the civil service, his belief in keeping African Americans in their proper place, his support screening Birth of a Nation in the White House, his actions in Haiti, you can go on and on and on. You know, these were ultimately his decisions and were deeply reflective of his racial views.
Yeah, Haiti's another one that doesn't get mentioned. We hear a lot about the Birth of the Nation and the various, because it's some quotes are used. He doesn't, as you point out in your book, he doesn't deny those quotes,
books, they're out of context from what Wilson had said, but he doesn't deny it. He says this is wonderful. It's like telling history with lightning. Yeah. Now, that could either be a great thing about the movie, how well, because to this day, people look at Griffith as a great movie maker, but, or it could be comments. There's some actions by Tumulty, of course, to clean up afterwards and say, well, stop saying Wilson endorses your movie, but he never denies it. He never decries it or anything close to that. So
And of course he's a graduate, fellow graduate student with Thomas Dixon. So they knew each other, but I think, you know, going back to Du Bois, Du Bois and Wilson have a really interesting relationship, which I explore in the book. I probably could have gone much, much deeper. But in some ways, they were kind of kindred spirits, obviously coming from very different backgrounds, different perspectives. But they both held a very deep belief in the importance of democracy, not just as a political system, but democracy as a way of life, a way of organizing society, of organizing the world as a principle, as an ethic. And that really kind of brought Wilson and Du Bois together when it came to support for World War One, when Woodrow Wilson makes the charge, the claim that the United States is entering the war to make the world safe for democracy. That's something that resonates with Du Bois. He's obviously thinking about democracy in terms of African Americans and other peoples of African descent. But both Wilson and Du Bois see World War One as this moment to really remake democracy on a global scale.
There might be an assumption that because he ended up not liking Wilson very much, or certainly didn't have much reason to, that maybe he was just enamored with the other presidents, and obviously didn't support Taft for reelection. Teddy Roosevelt, Harding, Coolidge, did he have, you know, opinions of these presidents as well?
Yeah, Du Bois was always very opinionated. And pretty much every issue of the crisis that coincided with a national election, he weighed in. Certainly after his mistaken belief in Woodrow Wilson and the Democrats, he was certainly very skeptical of supporting any Democratic candidates. You know, after he becomes more and more disillusioned with the political process and the two-party system throughout the interwar period, he supports third party candidates, Socialist Party candidates. You know, by the end of his life, he's you know, kind of resigned to not voting for any candidates at all, because he feels that it's not going to make any difference, that the American political system had become so broken and that democracy had become such a distant reality.
And he takes kind of a second bet. He takes a bet on Wilson in the beginning, doesn't work out. And he kind of, as the run-up to World War One begins, he takes kind of a second bet. I personally don't see it as much of a leap, because I do understand it, that if African-Americans fight in World War One in defense of democracy, and we don't want the German system, they will be able to make that case that we deserve full rights. And you see 9th and 10th Cavalry at San Juan Hill, the lesser known today about the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812, the bravery shown at Civil War, which if we just fight this world war and we're seen on the stage as brave fighters, we'll gain more and more rights. I mean, totally logical to me. It's happened with a lot of different groups.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And that was really Du Bois's logic. As a historian, as someone who was born just a few years after the Civil War, I mean, he had a deep appreciation for and even reverence for the Black military tradition, going back to the American Revolution. His great-great-grandfather was very proud of him serving in the American Revolution. His father briefly served in the Civil War. So he definitely linked war and Black military service in particular, with the acquisition of citizenship rights and the broader acquisition of freedom. I think he, and he was not alone in that view. Mm-hmm. Many other African Americans felt that way as well. But when it came to World War One, I would argue that the vast majority of African Americans were apathetic towards their participation, their active participation in the war, especially considering the conditions that they were facing socially, politically, economically, as the United States entered the war, in terms of just horrific racial discrimination and violence, disenfranchisement, economic exploitation. You go on and on and on. For many African Americans, when Woodrow Wilson says that the United States is going to fight to make the world safer democracy, they're more concerned about democracy for them in the United States.
And one of the ideas that I know Du Bois to kind of double consciousness, which is, you know, you're an American, but also an African American, and you just can't get away from that. And I imagine a lot of people feel that that's never has changed. You know, it's, we should make it clear that he's really pushing that we that African Americans must join, you know, support this cause and be Americans first.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point and a point that I really emphasize in my book. Du Bois talks about this notion of double consciousness in his 1903 classic book, The Souls of Black Folk, these two warring ideals, as he characterizes them, of being Black and of being American, and the desire to merge these two aspects of African-American identity. And in some ways, World War One is his opportunity to put theory into practice, to see if it was indeed possible for African-Americans to be fully American. And he believed that the war was potentially that opportunity. He really put his credibility on the line in fighting and encouraging African-Americans to demonstrate their loyalty, their patriotism as 100% American citizens, both in terms of their support for the war, but also in terms of their service in the military.
He's disappointed. I mean, I think the first thing to say is that the government does include African-Americans in the selective service as soon as the war is declared, and they're not looking for African-Americans to be in combat. There has to be a movement to fight for that already when Du Bois does get over to France or starts hearing things. There's all sorts of trouble.
Yeah. I mean, as I talk about in my book and go into a lot of detail, Du Bois was at the forefront of nearly every issue related to African Americans during the war, and in particular as it related to their experiences in the Army, of advocating for an officer's training camp, which was segregated, organized in Fort Des Moines, Iowa, pushing for the creation of an all-Black combat division, the 92nd Division, composed of draftees, which was led by Black officers, trying to ensure that the draft was being implemented fairly. So he was deeply invested in all of these various issues related to African Americans during the war, corresponding with Newton Baker on multiple occasions, fighting for his friend Charles Young to not be prematurely retired from the Army. So he was, in many ways, using the war as a continuation of his activism and support for African-American civic equality. But certainly when the war comes to a conclusion and he goes to France, again, I talk about in my book how he was able to actually get a passport to go to France. He is shocked by what he hears directly from the mouths of Black soldiers and officers about the horrific racial discrimination and institutionalized white supremacy that they experienced in France. And it's the beginnings of his disillusionment with the war, something that, as I talk about in the book, he reckons with for really two decades, from one world war to the next.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, and a reminder, we're talking to Chad Williams, the author of The Wounded World, W.E.B. Du Bois, and the First World War. And he makes the decision, hearing things like Officer Charles Young, who we should mention was brave officer, well-regarded for his service in the Mexican intervention that had just happened. And then they're inventing all of these things to get him disqualified. And there's many stories like that. So they're not treating the officer corps of African-Americans well. There just seems to always be this whole propaganda operation before the war and after to rewrite what happened. So there'll be a battle or there'll be some action like, well, really, it was if it wasn't for those white officers, they would have never done well. And as you reveal, he wanted to, or at least had the idea of assembling a book.
Yeah, and that's really the central thread of my book. Du Bois was committed to writing what would have been the definitive history of the Black experience in the war. In October 1918, he's charged by the NAACP Board of Directors for starting to compile information for a book on the Black experience in the war. He goes to France to begin research for this book. And he's deeply aware, to your point, of the racist slander attempts on the part of white military officials to rewrite the history of Black military service and the war specifically, so that African Americans don't have a place in that history. So he is very committed to addressing the slander, of refuting the lies and distortions that are already beginning to be propagated immediately after the war comes to an end. So Du Bois writing the history of the war immediately becomes deeply personal for him and something that he commits to and spends, as I talk about in the book, really over 20 years trying to write this incredible history that to this point, no other historian other than myself has gone into any detail exploring its significance, what it meant to Du Bois's life, but also why it was important to the broader history of Black freedom and struggles for democracy in the 20th century.
First of all, he's the heavyweight. So if you're going to come out with a book to counter propaganda, you give it to your heavyweight. And it looks like some of the soldiers who are there, that they're willing to sort of surrender their photographs, their recollections, their memories, and he's gathering detail. It becomes clear as the years go on that he's not going to be able to finish the book for a variety of reasons, but he doesn't always return some of these items. And it seems like through your book, there's some examples of people getting a little frustrated about it. Even one where there's a case where they needed immediately to refute what a white officer previously had been somewhat nice to them and now was writing this propaganda in the middle 20s, probably to boost his own career. You know, it seems like, yeah, he keeps asking Du Bois, like, can you give that back to me? And he's just holding it. I mean, that just creates there's a lot there. some is like, why does this happen to him? And then the ethics of that as a, you know, as a historian.
I mean, one of the most fascinating relationships that I explore in my book is between Du Bois and Black veterans. So really immediately when the war comes to an end, when he goes to France, Black veterans are investing their historical visions, their hopes for telling their story in Du Bois, right? And he's encouraging them to provide him with documents, letters, photographs, just incredible trove of materials that he envisions using to write his history, to make it authentic, and to make it irrefutable. And he continues to collect materials over the years. He incorporates them into the manuscript that he's writing, which ultimately swells to over 800 pages. But he doesn't return most of these materials, even though, as you mentioned, many veterans, particularly by the 1920s and 1930s, are clamoring to have their materials back. It reflects Du Bois' ego, his selfishness, that he felt that these materials were better off in his hands. But it also, I think, is illustrative of the inner conflict that Du Bois had as well, that as he struggled with the history of the war, as he struggled with his disillusionment with the war, as he struggled with his own guilt about supporting the war, he used the writing of this history as a way to reckon with all of those conflicting emotions. And that really led him to make some very questionable ethical decisions, which for me as a historian were important for me to talk about in my book. And I think are still important today, especially when we consider that all of those materials that Du Bois collected are still sitting in an archive right now.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, your book, it's a novel. It could be a novel. This story could be a novel or a movie, this story of Du Bois and his struggle. And that's why I think the book is entertaining as well as informative because of that, really getting into Du Bois. And Du Bois is somebody who's greatly revered. So to even touch on some of the lesser qualities, you know, is a big thing. I guess two questions there. You could comment somewhat on just that, Du Bois as a person. And then you're writing this book as well. You're assembling materials. Did you ever feel any commonality with him?
Yeah, there are many times where I thought I might end up like Du Bois and never finishing my book. that would have been very meta. But Du Bois is, as we started off the conversation, a one of a kind figure. He is truly larger than life. Very easy to get seduced by him, to kind of fall into hagiography in writing about such an incredible individual like Du Bois. But I really wanted to explore his full complexity and his full humanity. And I think that really comes out in my book, where we see Du Bois in all of his brilliance, all of his accomplishments, but also we see Du Bois in all of his flaws and in all of his failures as well, right? To think about Du Bois as somehow failing, you know, when it comes to eventually completing his book, when it comes to the failure of World War I itself, that was something that I really wanted to struggle with. And I think provides an opportunity for us to appreciate Du Bois in a new way.
Yeah, I think there's two other things. One is it's not just that he believes that the service by African Americans in World War I will lead to better civil rights at home, but he's also got his eye on Africa. And there's German colonies. So right there, you have, especially as you get near the end of the war, they know where it's going. They're going to either we're going to win, or at least they're going to have to give those up. There's opportunities there, and maybe even to have a little bit of a early independence movement or some cooperation. He also seems to prophesize the peace at Versailles won't stick, that World War II is likely.
Du Bois was incredibly prophetic in identifying the roots of the war in empire and colonial competition amongst the European belligerents for control of Africa, its human and material resources. And this was one of his main arguments in supporting the war, that it can be used as an opportunity to kind of begin the process of dismantling the imperial system. And he also recognized that if the question of empire was not adequately addressed, it could indeed lead to future conflicts. And he was absolutely right about that. As I talk about in my book, he was at the forefront of the campaign or the movement to address the aggression of Italy when it came to Ethiopia in the early 1930s. And he saw that as an illustration of how this question of imperial and imperial violence in Africa had not been addressed in the aftermath of World War I, how it was continuing during the interwar period, and how ultimately it would lead to an even more catastrophic conflict, which, as we all know, happened with World War II.
And when that war comes, he's much more ambivalent than he was during the run-up to World War I.
Yes, he is. And that's a really reflection of just the evolution of his disillusionment, his coming to the realization that World War I was indeed a complete failure, but also the hardening of his anti-war principles and beliefs, which was tied to him trying to write the history of the war. By the time he is, you know, working on his book by the mid-1930s, he's envisioning it as an anti-war book, as a lesson about the horrors of modern warfare. He gives up working on the book, not coincidentally, in 1940, just as Hitler is about to lead his campaign into the West and invade France. And he's much more cynical about the outcomes of World War II, seeing that democracy was not achieved during World War I, did not exist prior to World War II, and certainly was not going to exist after World War II as well. Grudgingly accepts that African Americans are going to have to do their role, but is under no misgivings that anything positive is going to come out of this war.
Other than what we discussed today, we covered a lot that's in the book and everything. Is there something we missed? Is there anything else that's important for listeners to know about W.E.B. Du Bois and your book?
Well, Du Bois is someone that we all need to know of and to think about in terms of his relevance today. The title of my book is The Wounded World, and that was inspired by the title of Du Bois's book that he didn't finish, which he titled The Black Man and the Wounded World. And that title is so evocative and resonant and speaks to, I think, the larger question that he was trying to answer. What does it mean to live in a wounded world? What does it mean to live in a world that is scarred, that is wounded by war, by violence, by racism and white supremacy, by empire and colonialism? Those were the pressing questions that Du Bois was wrestling with during his lifetime. And those are still questions that we're wrestling with today.
Chad Williams, thanks for coming on My History Can Beat Up Your Politics.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I want to thank Chad Williams for coming on the program. Remember his book, The Wounded World, W.E.B. Du Bois and the First World War, Chad Williams. What can I say about it? We're touching on a subject here. We're just touching on the surface of it. If you want to read about some of the tragedies that occurred during this time and to see more of the history of how Du Bois is constantly confounded by it, unable to get away from this problem of, I thought if we just fought in a war, things would be better. In much more detail, I suggest you get this book, The Wounded World, Chad L. Williams. Thanks for listening.